Welcome, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more tells his or her story.
Cindy Lou, I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on, and this is the website, aabluechipspeakers.org. That's aabluechipspeakers.org. Desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. All right, and so now I am going to introduce the speaker. It's my honor to be here, and I was asked by Avery, my sponsoree, to introduce her. And I hang out at Triangle and at Clarkston Group, but this is where I went to my very first meeting, women's meeting. And I really didn't get it. I thought it was a diet. Went home and finished off the wine, you know. Then I'll start tomorrow, you know. Well, this ain't no diet, and I do have this thing, as they say here. But Avery, I want to say a couple things about her. She showed up at the place where I picked up the white chip that stuck, which is at Triangle Women's Meeting, 10:30 a.m., and I saw her across the room, and I noticed immediately how beautiful she was. And that's not unusual. A lot of beautiful women in Alcoholics Anonymous, just for the record. You know, we get prettier as we get sober. What is that? I don't know. I had pasty skin, and I weighed 210 pounds when I got here. But it's fattening. But I digress. I noticed how beautiful she was, but most important, what stood out to me was her commitment and her willingness to go to any lengths. She was from out of town. She said, look, I'm from out of town. I don't know anybody. And she just made herself known. She named and claimed her seat. And then I just went up over to her, and she was so immediately authentic with me that I thought, this girl is going to make it. You know, that was my immediate thought. And so we met later and talked, and I know a lot of her story, but I'll bet I'll get bits and pieces that I haven't heard before. So it is my honor to present to you, Avery.
Hi, I'm Avery. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Tim for asking me to speak tonight. I'm very honored and grateful to be here and to share my story with you. I'll start off by saying I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about my childhood and war stories of what my drinking looked like, mainly because my childhood has no relevance to my alcoholism, really, or my recovery from it. My childhood was great. I had a wonderful family. There's no alcoholism in my family, no history of alcoholism, so this was kind of a new thing that we all had to deal with when it came to fruition later on. But what I will say is that growing up, I never felt a part of. So I don't know if that's something that people can relate to, and I didn't know what that was growing up, but there was everybody else, and then there was me. And I always kind of felt very uncomfortable in my skin. That was something that I remember very far back, trying to fit in and not feeling like I something felt different, you know, and the people around me seemed to be able to do life very easily. Even at an early age, I felt that way. And even through middle school, I was very uncomfortable as a child. And I put on a lot, you know. I was a very good actress, and I still can be a good actress. You know, I played the part well. My brother told me I was the best actress he'd ever seen at about, I was probably 6 months sober, and I was like, I'm sober. This is what AA looks like. And he was like, we've heard this before. Like, show me, you know? And I was like, that's so mean. But I had done a lot of damage in my family at that point. So he was, like, fed up. He was like, you told me this last year when you, you know, whatever. So I digress. Going back, my first drink was when I was 14 years old, and I was a freshman in high school, and I remember, like, it was yesterday, and the vodka drink was some kind of juice or something. Oh, also, disclaimer, I'm going to try not to use profanity, but I apologize in advance if it happens, because that's just who I am. I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, this feels so good. It was such a relief to me, because my mind, even at 14 years old, my mind was so full of that list of things, like 100 forms of self-delusion and fear and self-centered, like all of, it was madness up there. And I was a freshman in high school. Like, I don't know what I had to be worried about, but I was consumed with self, even at that age. And when I had that first sip of alcohol, once it started to kick in, and the second drink, and there was no time in my drinking history where there was, like, oh, I tried a sip of beer, and then, like, late. No. Like, I had that vodka drink and had, like, 7 more after that, you know, and I don't remember the rest of the night. But I do remember before I blacked out thinking, I want to do this all the time. Like, I want to feel this way as much as possible, because I'm comfortable, I feel good in my skin. All of that madness and the chatter and the fear and the do they like me and the all of that stuff finally shut up. I finally shut it up. I found what it was that was, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but it was my solution. You know, it calmed me down, and it was great. When I found alcohol, I thought, well, now I can live life. Like, I can do this life thing if I have this. You know, this makes it easier on me. And out of respect for the traditions, I'm not going to talk about drugs that much, and, you know, outside issues and whatnot. There are drugs in my story, so for all of you that are drug addicts and, you know, can't relate, but I'm just going to talk about my drinking. But just know that I partied and I did everything alcoholically, if you know what I mean. There was no moderation in anything that I did for a very long time. So that being said, after that first time I got drunk, all through high school, I played volleyball competitively, so we traveled a lot around the nation, and we played in nationals, and we were the real deal, and it was serious, and I loved it, and I was good at it, and it was something that was my outlet, and it was in my whole life. And so there wasn't a whole lot of space for drinking. There was a little space, and I took it. You know, every chance I got, every weekend there was that I wasn't on the road, I was drunk. And, you know, got a fake ID junior year, was at the bars. I'm 17 years old, you know, like at the bars in downtown Austin. Oh, I'm from Austin, by the way. And it's so funny looking back, because I just saw nothing wrong with that. Like, I really didn't. And I think my parents also, you know, they're cool. They're cool people. You know, they drank in high school. And I think that for a long time, they were just, I seemed like a normal kid. You know, high school kids drink. They go to parties. They get drunk. And I think that it took me a very long time to be able to have some perspective on my behavior as not normal, you know, and blacking out and driving drunk when you're a junior in high school and taking Everclear to a football game is not normal behavior. I thought it was brilliant because it didn't smell. I thought I was a genius. I got caught, so, like, that's my first consequence. You know, I'm junior in high school, everything's going great. I'm a captain of the volleyball team, and I waltz into the, you know, stadium, which is school property, with the Everclear grain alcohol. My mom found that out. She was like, really? Like, we're here? Like, grain alcohol? Why? That didn't seem strange to me. And I got caught, and that was my very first terrifying moment of, oh my God, you know, like, there's a cop, I'm getting escorted, like, everybody's looking at me, you know, this is really bad, my mom's going to be pissed. And at that time, volleyball was the most important thing to me, and I was going for a scholarship. You know, you pay all this money, you travel all over the country, and the goal is you get a scholarship. That's what everybody was doing around me, that's what was expected of me, and that's what my goal was. And when that happened, as I'm standing there with the cop underneath the bleachers, I was like, my life is over. You know, I'm screwed. The result of that was kind of interesting. So my family, in their good-natured Al-Anon-ness, came to the rescue. They brought in cavalry. They brought in the lawyer, and they brought in my therapist. They went to the superintendent because there was a zero-tolerance policy at my school. If you were on school property with alcohol, you were at the alternative learning center for 2 weeks, which is a really scary place. And I was in all AP classes, and my family was like, there's no way that you're punishing my daughter by taking away her education for 2 weeks. So that was kind of the first rescue that happened for me, which taught me a lesson. It was kind of like, oh, screw up, that'll take care of it. And that was kind of a pattern that continued until, you know, that was no longer an option. Captainship got taken away, got suspended from the most important game of my life that year, and I didn't stop drinking. Went to the Alternative Learning Center, where the kids go that stab their teachers. Like, scary kids. I'm crying the whole time. Like, from the 8 a.m. at the breakfast table, I am freaking out. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here. It was hard. It was a very bizarre punishment for me. But there was no stopping. I was mad I got caught. I was like, well, this sucks. I'm going to try to be more careful next time. That was my thought process. So, moving forward, you know, senior year, I got a scholarship anyway. You know, I played really hard. I worked really hard, and I only partied when it was, conducive, and somebody recruited me, and I went to a school up east, and senior year for me was a joke, because I'd signed my letter of intent in November, so I think I had like 36 excused absences in calculus my senior year, because I started writing my own notes freshman year. Like, every note that I was actually sick, my mom wrote a note, and I would take that note and throw it away and write my own note, so all of my notes in my file looked the same, because I'd written them all. I'm a smart little alcoholic. That's when I think the abnormal drinking, I think my parents started to kind of go, like, she's a drinker, you know? Like, she sure is a drinker. And my dad always said, you know, you call me. Don't get in a car with somebody who's driving drunk. Don't drive drunk. I'll come and get you. And I did. I called him a couple of times, and he came and got me, no questions asked. And, I don't know. I think when I went up to school in Pittsburgh, you know, I was out of place. I was scared shitless, and I did not fit in. And, again, there wasn't a lot of time for drinking because I was up, you know, collegiate athletics is hard. You know, it was difficult for me, and I was in a place that was really cold, and it was a difficult year. But my blackout drinking was very present. I would drink in my dorm room. I would hide liquor in my dorm closets. And, you know, I remember being my first Red Bull vodka experience. Ended up, like, jacked out of my head on Red Bull and sick and throwing up in the communal dorm bathroom. Like, this is awful. But just kind of like, well, that's just part of the game. I think that the rationalizations that I had over the years of, like, you know, I couldn't see. I couldn't see until I saw. And I just, things would happen, and I would just brush them off and be like, oh, you don't know where your car is. You don't know where you are. You know, you're making decisions at 3 in the morning in alleys, you know, that anything could have happened. And I remember just being like, it's no big deal. It's just, this is who I am. And I became this person when I was drinking that I was so insecure. God, I hated myself. I really hated myself. And I didn't want anyone to see that. I didn't want anyone to know how much I was just so insecure. So I overcompensated. And I would act so confident. And I would just be so dominating. And I would command all the attention in the room. And I thought that was cute. I thought it was, like, charismatic, and people liked it, and I was, like, the, you know, the center of attention. And I thought that was who I wanted to be. And you know, looking back, I think it was, I was empty and lonely and in pain, and I didn't know it. I didn't even know it. And so that freshman year, I decided I wasn't going to come back. I was like, I can't do this whole, I'm not cracked up. I can't do this whole college athletics thing. It's just too hard. Plus, I just hated it up there, and I wanted to go back to Texas. So I worked really hard, and I put my willpower into school, and I got a 4.0, and I said, I want to go to Texas. I want to go to the University of Texas. That's where my dad went, and I did it. And I got in, and I moved back down to Austin. I don't know if anybody knows anything about Austin, but it is a fun place. It is a fun place, and University of Texas is a fun place. And at that point in my life, I'm 19 years old. I am no longer supposed to be at the gym at 5 a.m. I do not have that athletic identity anymore, and I am ready to go. That's when a lot of my drug use, I think, kind of popped up onto the scene, and I started to get into the music scene a lot and go into a lot of shows, and that persona that I talked about kind of developed into the mess. The party girl became the party mess. And I think, looking back, you know, the consequences that happened during my drinking, I was unable to see until I worked the steps. I don't know. My story, for the most part, during those years, I don't remember a lot. Like, it's just, it's really blurry, because those years that I was at the University of Texas, it was a party. All the time, every day. If it was after noon, I was drinking or doing something. And drinking for me, I loved being drunk. Loved being drunk. You know, being drunk was my favorite thing to do, to get drunk, because I'm a drunk. And at the time, I couldn't see that all of the things that were still down here that I was masking and masking and masking and drinking away were festering, you know, and it was alcoholism. I didn't know what it was at the time. I knew there was something wrong with me, and I would go to therapists, and I would talk about myself, because we all like to do that. And my therapist helped me with all kinds of stuff. Didn't do much for my alcoholism, but I tried, you know. I knew there was something wrong, and I was trying to find help because I thought I had some psychological problems, or that, you know, maybe medicine would help or something like that. Because I don't know if you guys can relate to this, but like, you start to feel a little crazy, and drinking is the only thing that helps. You know, it's like being sober is uncomfortable when you're an alcoholic, and you don't, you know, it's. I felt like my skin was going to fall off when I tried not to drink, you know, because it was just like, oh, don't touch me. Whatever you're saying is irritating me. I was a monster when I didn't have alcohol. And looking back now, like, my self-centered behavior during that time, I would push my parents. My parents are loving, wonderful people. And I did some things, you know, my dad would come and try to check on me in my apartment, and I pushed him away, like physically pushed him, leave me alone. And that's something that I had to make amends for in sobriety, because that hurt him. You know, I did things to my family that you can't undo, you know, and you can make amends for them. You know, I've righted those wrongs by living a sober life today and making amends to my parents. And I do that every single day that I don't take a drink. I make that right. But going through and looking back, that self-centered behavior and how destructive that is for me ended up, you know, at the very end, my story spirals really quickly. So, well, I mean, I thought so. But then again, I went and did my alcohol history, and I was like, man, this is bad for a while. I just really couldn't see it. But it got real, real bad in the last 6 months that I was out there. I tried to get sober on my own. I, you know, went through a bad breakup and was inconsolable and was drinking every single night. And I was doing everything I could get my hands on, you know. I could not cope with life. I could not face life. And I would watch these people. I'd be, you know, the sun's coming up. I'm still awake. I'm watching these people walk to work. And I'm like, how do you do that? I mean, really, like looking out my window going like, how is it possible that you're doing that? Because it was beyond me to try to figure out on my own how to live life. It was just seemed too hard. And I'll go back a little bit. When I was at UT, I couldn't show up for class. I couldn't make it. And I would try so hard, and I would, you know, I'd withdraw from all my classes, and then I'd be like, okay, next semester, next semester, next semester. And I would go home, I'd cry to my parents, and I'd be like, I'm this, that, and the other on the laundry list of psychological problems that I thought I had, and I would medical withdrawal, and then, you know, spring semester would come, and I'd get up my go-to-office max, and we'd get, like, highlighters, and I'd be like, oh, ready. I'm like, I'm organized, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get my life together. And I would, you know, I didn't know that drinking, that alcoholism was my problem. I don't want to say drinking was my problem, because drinking was my answer. My problem was my alcoholism, and I dropped out. You know, my biggest goal, graduate from the University of Texas. I was like, I can't do it. I can't do this. I mean, I can't show up for class. I can't get out of bed. I just, it all seemed like too much. And after that, I started dating a drug dealer, which was awesome. My parents were thrilled. And things got really dark for a little while. And I have an eating disorder as well, so all of that kind of spiraled during that time. And I had a moment of clarity where I looked myself in the mirror and was like, I hate this life. And I left him and called my dad, because my dad's always there. My dad is always, always, always there. And said, I need help. And so I moved back in with my parents and thought I got everything together. I stopped doing a lot of things. Didn't quit drinking, but stopped doing all the bad stuff. And I was like, I'll just drink. And things looked up for a while. And it talks about that in the book. It's like, we'll get our life together and then we'll burn it all down. And that was my period of like, okay, we're going to do it this time. Things are good. I feel good. I'm, like, exercising. And then, you know, sure enough, I went back to school. You know, I really did try to get my life together, but I didn't quit drinking. And it didn't matter what I did. It's like all this stuff over here. If I didn't get sober and take care of my alcoholism, it didn't matter. And I didn't know that at the time. And I needed to go through all of the things that I went through. So it got bad again, you know, and I got to a place where in the last couple of months I couldn't get out of bed, and I was doing all kinds of, I was trying so hard not to drink, and I knew that, like, something was wrong, and, you know, the man I was dating at the time was like, you need help, I'm gone, and I was devastated, and I couldn't leave the bed, and I was just drinking and passing out, and I was just unconscious. I wanted to be unconscious. God, just make me unconscious. You know, because being conscious sucks. Being conscious hurts. Being conscious is painful, and I cannot do this. I cannot get my life together. It's too hard. It's too big of a mountain, and I'd rather just be unconscious because it's easier. It feels better. And then one morning, well, got a DUI. As I was trying not to drink, you know, going out, and it's like, somebody has a birthday dinner. It's like, okay, I'll go out and just not drink. Yeah. Got wasted, as we do, and had to call my dad at 2 a.m. and say, I'm in jail. And he started crying, and I started crying. And I'm looking around, and there's this visibly trashed woman going, it's not that big a deal. I was like, shut up, it's a huge deal. I was like, this is a huge deal. And I was like, I don't belong here. I don't know what's happened. I don't know how I got here. I was supposed to be like I had so much potential, and I'm sitting here in a jail cell, and it's not supposed to be like this. And after that, I continued to try not to drink. And in trying not to drink, I picked up a lot of weird stuff to try to get high, and, you know, I was just so miserable. And I remember I was staying with my parents, and I just was a mess. I was a mess without a drink. That was when I really realized, like, something's wrong with me, you know, because I remember the conversation after my first DUM. My mom was like, well, I mean, you have to stop drinking now. And I was like, yeah, you're right, because you got a DUI, you got to stop drinking. And I just thought, like, okay, so I'll just stop drinking. Most miserable 2 weeks of my life. Was at my parents' house, wrecked the car, put in my car, just stuck there all in the house. No drinks. God, it was awful. And during that few months, I wrecked 3 cars. I would go out and I'd get trashed and wreck a car, and my dad would be like, okay. You know, pick up the pieces. And I went to treatment for 28 days and thought I had this thing. Say it's over probably 4 days. Got involved with somebody and relapsed, and relapsed bad. Wrecked another car. Then, you know, I researched some places here in Georgia. And at this point, I was desperate. I was like, something is wrong with me. I need help. I can't do this anymore. I was crying. I remember my mom told me later that I looked at her and I said, I feel like something has claws on my brain. And such a visual thing for me now looking back, because it is how I felt. It's like, I can't figure this out. And I'm trying really hard, but I can't figure this out. And we found a place here in Georgia, and I had a flight on Tuesday morning to go to treatment. And Monday afternoon, my dad came home from his lunch break. And forgive me, I might struggle getting through the story, but I didn't have a car. I had wrecked all the cars. My dad had a car, and left his keys on the hook, went to take a nap. And I sat on my mom's bed, and I sat there. Said, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. I really don't want to do this. And I got up off the bed, and I took his keys, got the car, and went and got. Wrecked his car and drove it into a building, people in it. And I'd walked from our house. And I woke up. It's glass everywhere, and there's women in the salon, a little bit freaked out. And Tahoe in the plate glass window of this office building with retail on the first floor. And I said, you got to call my dad, you know. There's ambulances and fire trucks. You got to call my dad, you got to call my dad. So my dad wakes up from his nap, and my dad has a defibrillator in his chest. He's got a heart problem. He's, like, running down the street as fast as he can. It's like, please, God, just don't let this thing go off at my chest before I get there. And there's traffic's blocked off, ambulances, fire trucks. I'm on a stretcher, and he is flipping out. He's like, let me see my daughter, let me see my daughter, let me see my daughter. And they won't let him. They're restraining him. These cops are restraining him. They said, sir, you need to calm down. And I was unhurt. I don't know how that happened, but I woke up and was like, how does this happen again? How is this happening again? This isn't even my car. Like, why? You know, why is this happening? And I know now, because I had to be desperate to do this. That was the day that keeps me sober. You know, I remember that today and think, God, I never want to go back there. I never want to go back there. And, you know, my at the hospital, and I'm faking a panic attack so I can get some Valium because I know I'm going to jail. so I'm like, you know, do your best panic attack impression. Which always works. The nurses are always real nice, so I hate that I know that. But, you know, which they gave to me, and I'm at this point just like, I'm screwed. And I'm in the jail cell planning to take a cab and get more booze before I have to go for treatment the next day. I'm like, if I can just get one more, I can just get one more in me, and then I'll go. And then, of course, I walked out, and my dad's sitting there. I've been waiting there for 2 hours, and I was like, boiled again. And he said, let's go home. And so I went home, and the next day I went to treatment and spent 11 months in a residential treatment center in Statesboro, which was the hardest thing I'd ever had to do. Every day was hard. Getting sober was really hard. But at the time, it was so much better than what I had been doing. And my recovery today, you know, I picked up my 3-year chip in April, and this year has been the most amazing year yet. You know, the first year was rough. Second year was kind of figuring shit out and being confusing, and I made mistakes. I made really bad decisions in sobriety, but I stayed sober. I did not follow sponsor's instructions, but I stayed sober, and I didn't drink, and I learned lessons, and I remained teachable, and I continued to keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back. And today I'm so grateful, not for what I've gotten back, but for what I'm able to give to people, because I am truly the person that I'm meant to be today because of AA. AA allowed me to clear the wreckage of my past and live a life today where I can be useful to people and be the loving girlfriend, the loving daughter, the loving sister, the loving friend that everybody in my life deserves today, and the one that I wasn't for a very long time. I was wrapped up in my own self and my own alcoholism for so long, and I get to make that right today. I get to be there for people. I get to help and watch women walk in and go, I don't know what I'm doing. How is it possible to do this? And I get to say to them, like, it's possible. It's totally possible. And if you want it bad enough and you're willing to go to any lengths, one day at a time, this thing is the best thing that ever happened to me. And at the time, the idea of getting sober and not drinking was like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Like, this is the worst thing. I have to be in this treatment center with all these people, and I don't like them, and I keep doing stuff that I don't like, and I'm really angry anyway because I have to get sober. Like, I have, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm pissed. And now all you guys are doing all this stuff, and I want to yell at you, and I have an ego, so I think I'm right about everything. But this program and this literature, and, you know, I remember reading more about alcoholism for the first time and, like, bursting into tears, being like, oh, God, I have this thing. But I'm so glad. You know, I used to hear people talk about being grateful, recovering alcoholics, and I was like, you're not grateful. Come on. Who's grateful to have this? This sucks. But, you know, I think I am grateful, you know, because the life that I have in this room is much better and bigger than I ever could have imagined. It's hard to describe. I wish sometimes I could, like, encapsulate some of the feelings that I've had in recovery and give them to newcomers and be like, I know you feel like you're not going to be able to be yourself, and you're not going to be able to be cool, and you're not going to be able to have fun, and it's going to suck, and it's going to be hard, and all this stuff. And it's just, that's not my experience. My experience has been that, like, yeah, some stuff sucks, but everybody else goes through stuff that sucks too. You know, like, that's life. And I couldn't deal with life before, and now I'm able to deal with the stuff, and I don't have to ruin my life, kill myself, ruin everybody else's life around me in the process anymore. You know, I get to be somebody who contributes today. And, you know, I'll say this. I am capable of being in a loving and healthy relationship today, and I was never able to do that before. And I know that that is a gift of this program, and I'm really grateful for that. And I'm able to have relationships with my family that are better than they ever were, you know? And there's not a price or a value you can put on that. And the amount of pain that I was in when I got here, I was desperate. You know, I looked at them, I was like, you want me to go to a treatment center with all girls for a year? Fine. Fine. I'm that miserable. And I'm so grateful for those days that I thought, God, why is this happening to me? You know, like, why is this so bad? You know, why is this happening to me? This is so hard. I'm so grateful for those, because I don't know if I would be able to do those steps on the wall and be super honest with somebody and make the right decisions, which are usually the hard, uncomfortable ones, if I didn't have something that was going to kill me and take me to this awful, sad, dark, miserable place as my other option. That's my other option. I can do this. It's like it talks about in the book. Accept spiritual help or ride this thing out to the gates of hell, basically. And we all, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I was in hell. And recovery every day, like, the things that I learn from people in these rooms, you know, because I can't take credit for this. I don't know how I got so lucky. I don't know how the gift of desperation was given to me. I don't know why I got to get sober and other people are out there dying. I don't know why that is, but I'm so grateful for it. Because I have a life today that I could never imagine, and it starts with the fact that I love myself. And I was never able to even look at myself in the mirror without seeing all the ugly and all of the sadness and all of the pain. And now I get to look at myself and see the esteemable acts that I do and the person that I've become, which is really the person that I really was. And AA has allowed me to be that person. And to live one day at a time and to be in the moment and to be grateful and to be able to not react to every single little thing my self-centered mind can wrap itself around is a gift. It's so freeing. It's so freeing to be able to have a way of life. This is a design for living. And I implore you, if you're new, it's okay to be scared. It's okay to be uncomfortable and not okay. And you just have to keep coming back and keep doing what we ask you to do. And eventually the promises will come true. And the promises in that book, there's not just the 9-step promises that it talks about at the beginning of the meeting. There's a lot of promises in that book. And I'm just grateful for the people in my life, like great sponsorship, and the women in the program that taught me how to do this. Because I didn't know how to live when I got here. I didn't know how to be a good person. I didn't know how to be humble. I didn't know how to be helpful. I didn't know how to not be wrapped up in Avery every second of every day from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed. I didn't know how to not be like that. Somebody had to teach me that. So I've run out of things to say, so I think that's usually the universe telling me that it's time to stop. So if you're new, keep coming back. We love you.
Well, I'm sure I'm not alone. My impression, that was an inspiring story. Thank you very much. And thank you for speaking very clearly. Tinsley, would you come up?
First I slip, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Below there's a vision Take me where the promises.